So we continue our sermon series on Christianity and world religions, and today we're going to take a sneak peek into Buddhism. There are about half a billion Buddhist practitioners around the world. That's a little less than 10% of the world's population, but that number is really difficult to quantify because Buddhism in and of itself is not actually a religion per se. I've often been known to say that you can be a Christian Buddhist because their practices can be applied to our own faith tradition. And so it's hard to put a number on how many Buddhists there are in the world. Buddhist beliefs vary widely, and their philosophies are subject to a huge variety of interpretations. So every week you're going to hear me remind us that these are broad brushstrokes, that I am not speaking for all Buddhists, but that then there's always room for growth in our learning. And so if there's something in the sermon that piques your curiosity, I encourage you to visit our library. And to talk to folks that you know who practiced Buddhism. Buddhism has a very interesting origin story. There was a man, a human man. His name was Siddhartha Gautama, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's where we're going to go with it. He was born in what we now know as Nepal, and about the same time that the Jewish people were in exile in Babylon, right? So we're talking about the mid-500s BC. Siddhartha was born into royalty. He was the son of a prince, but his mother died just after his birth, and his father wanted to protect his precious son from experiencing suffering. And so he tried to shield his son. He sheltered him from suffering. He wanted to make sure that he had only the best things in life. And so he lived a true life of luxury. Well, Siddhartha grew up and he married. He had his own son. But by the time he was 29, he started going through what many of us have gone through in our lives, these questions about who am I and what is my place and my purpose in this world? Now, he was born and raised in the Hindu faith, but he was a member of the warrior caste. This is when they still had caste systems. And so in order to approach God, unless you were a member of the priestly caste, you really couldn't approach God on your own, which is very familiar to us when you think about our Jewish history, right? You couldn't just make an offering to God. You had to take it to a priest, and a priest made the offering on your behalf. So this is not an uncommon practice in religions or belief systems at that time. So it's said that at 29, Siddhartha decided to journey away from his father's protective home in order to explore the city. He didn't go too far, but he wanted to find truth. And so he first came upon an old man who was bent over from age. He was probably suffering some aches and pains, and Siddhartha asked his charioteer, "Is this the fate of all people?" He had never seen suffering before. And the charioteer, of course, replied, "Well, yes, we all grow old." And Siddhartha was very troubled by this realization. So a few days later, he decided to travel into the city again. He could only take a little bit at a time. And so he goes out into the city again, and he saw a man who was so sick, he was really on his deathbed and suffering tremendously. Again, he said, "Is this the fate of all people?" And his charioteer said, "Yes, of course. We all grow old. We all suffer illness." And this took Siddhartha into deep despair and anxiety. A third time he ventured into the city and saw a funeral procession going by. He'd never seen a dead body before. He was very young when his mother had died. Nor had he witnessed grieving friends and family. "Is this the fate of all people?" he asked. And his charioteer said, "Yes, we all will die." Well, Siddhartha was overwhelmed with this existential truth, what we would call the realization of his own mortality and the mortality of people that he loved. I remember the first time I saw my father cry. I was devastated at the sight. It was at his grandmother's funeral, but it was a woman that I had never really known. And I didn't understand his pain, and it frightened me to see him that way. Well, when his mother died, my grandmother, I had my own experience with my mortality. You see, she and I had never been particularly close, but we share a lot of genetics. Oh my goodness. For anyone who had ever met my grandmother, they would always say, "Oh, you have her eyes." And if you've seen my eyes, they're very particular, icy blue color. I got them from her, and she gave them to my father, and I got them from him. And we both have diabetes, and we have a very similar body type. We have, like, my mother likes to tease us. I have no butt and, you know, like really skinny legs or muscular legs. And like, I gain all my weight in the middle and, oh, you're just like your grandmother. Well, when she died, I was actually working at the hospital where she was brought in. And the folks in the emergency department knew me well. I was a supervisor for the pharmacy technicians, so I was always on the floors and helping to fix machines and all kinds of things. And so they called the department to ask me to come down, specifically to help comfort my grandmother's partner. And so that time in the ED was really a bit surreal because I was at work. So, you know, I was in that kind of work mentality. And so I went down to the ED, and it didn't really click, I think, that that was my grandmother lying on the bed who had died. But I knew I needed to be there for Tom. And so I was comforting Tom in that moment. And then I went back after he went home, and they took care of everything. And you don't really see, they take care of everything for you. And I went back to work. Because it hadn't really stuck until I got home and I got ready for bed. I worked the second shift, so it was probably around 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'm getting ready for bed, and I had an anxiety attack. And I realized that I was thinking about all of the things that she and I had in common and how she was younger than I want to be when I die. I was struck by how sudden her death was, how there hadn't been any kind of warning, no signs. It just happened. And I was struck by the reality of my own mortality, the idea that that could happen to me at any moment. And so that was when I began my soul searching. Now, Siddhartha was wondering similar questions. How do we live in this world where we have this kind of angst and despair and anxiety and suffering all around us? How do we function? What do we do when everything is transient? Nothing is permanent. Nothing lasts forever. How do we live burdened with that kind of knowledge and still find joy? Well, Siddhartha tried everything to chase away his despair. He threw lavish parties and bought more material pleasures. Everything he could do, you name it, he tried it, and nothing worked. And so one night, he took a final look at his child and his wife while they slept. He left the palace and his life of prosperity to find answers. the answers specifically to human suffering. He found no comfort from religion because, remember, he had no concept of a personal relationship with God. That was reserved for the priestly caste. So he shed his prosperity and he decided to live in a state of extreme asceticism. It's said he fasted so long that he could survive on one grain of rice a day. Do you think that that worked? On the verge of starvation, he realized self-denial does not cure anxiety. He tried the middle road between pleasure and self-denial, but that didn't bring him comfort either. 6 years later, he finally had a revelation. He fell into a deep trance and believed that he had found the source of suffering and the path to overcoming it. We must let go of all the things that lead us to suffering. He reached enlightenment. And the Pali word for enlightenment is Bud. So he became the Buddha, the enlightened one. He never claimed to be a god. He is not worshipped as a god. He was a person who received insight into the nature of suffering and who could teach others a philosophy and a meditative system that could free humans from suffering in this life and deliver them from the endless reincarnations that Hinduism taught. So, some essential insights of Buddhism. Buddhism is the only major world religion that is officially non-theistic, meaning they do not affirm nor deny the existence of God. Buddha taught that God's existence is irrelevant for ending human suffering. After all, he never found any help from his religious deities nor its priests. Buddhists do not worship Buddha, as I said. They revere him and they look to him as a guide and as an example. So there are four noble truths in Buddhism, part of his revelation. First, life is characterized by suffering. We all suffer throughout our lives at various levels and of various types. Would you agree that suffering is a part of life? Okay. You might not agree with all of these. So I'm not going to ask you the rest of them. You're going to think about it in your own brain. Suffering, he believed, is caused by attachments. So it's not caused by external forces, but by our own clinging. We crave life, so we suffer when we face death. We crave to be loved, so we suffer from rejection. We crave food, so we suffer when we're hungry. So suffering is caused by our attachments, our cravings. We can overcome our attachments. We have the power within ourselves to detach ourselves from the things that we crave. When we are no longer attached to people or things, suffering ceases. And the fourth is that the path, the Holy Eightfold Path, is the way to overcome suffering. And as we progress along this path, it's not an all one and done kind of thing. You progress along the path, and so the effects of your craving, the ignorance, the delusions, we talked about ignorance last week with Hinduism, those things slowly, gradually disappear. So, what is this Holy Eightfold Path? I'm going to kind of go through them quickly. Right views, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, if you think about our Ten Commandments, they are based on the first, half of the commandments are about the ways that we are connected to God and the way we relate to God. And the rest of them are connected with to how we relate to each other, right? How we care for each other and respect each other. In a similar way, this eightfold path, the first six help us build good karma and avoid bad karma. He came from Hinduism, remember? So they're about how we deal with the things of this world and how we act in it. The last two help us find relief from our anxiety and fear, especially through the practice of meditation, mindfulness, concentration, right? We might say intentionality. That's a word that we're using now. And only when you have achieved enlightenment will you completely understand and do all eight all the time. You strive for them. You seek for them. These are ideals. Well, there are a lot of similarities between Hinduism and Buddhism, and as I've said, that's because Buddha was born a Hindu, and he held on to many of their beliefs like karma and reincarnation. But Buddhists do not believe in a soul. There is no essential you. We are all only karmic energy that is transferred to us from a past life and is no longer generated when we achieve enlightenment. Our journey ends with the extinction of our personal identity, and our energy joins with all the other energy in the universe. This is Buddhist nirvana, which is different from a Hindu's nirvana. When we begin to compare Buddhism with Christianity, it's important to note that many of Buddha's teachings were finally recorded around the same time as Jesus' birth and his ministries, right between 4 and 30-something AD. Buddha's teachings were being written while Jesus was alive and ministering. Some of his sayings are very similar. Hate is not conquered by hate. Hate is conquered by love. This law is eternal. What's something that Jesus said that sounds similar to that? Love your enemies, right? So that they're no longer enemies. There are many other sayings with which we would all agree, and we can admire and learn from the practice of Buddhist meditation practices. And not being attached to things that are not of lasting importance. Maybe you remember something that Jesus talked about, letting go of things that moths and rust would destroy. Don't build yourself things on this earth, build things in heaven, right? Well, last week we spoke about Christianity's difference between our beliefs about God being both transcendent and immanent, a God with whom we can have a personal relationship. And it's clear that Buddha never had this personal experience of God. At least I would say he never attributed it to God. I would wonder who revealed the truth about human suffering to him. But that's my own. And so he never looked for answers with God or about God. It's also important for us to note that we don't have to come up with a path to God or to comfort or joy all on our own. We don't have to figure that out because God has done that for us through Jesus. Jesus said, "I am the way and the life and the truth," right? Jesus also said that the path of life can be summarized in just two commandments. Love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. And God doesn't turn away from our suffering. God knows the reality of our suffering. God chose to experience it firsthand in the person and the life of Jesus Christ. And he lives through our suffering, through the presence of the Holy Spirit. God is close at hand when we suffer. It is God who works within us to transform us and perfect us. John Wesley, and in your hymnal you can find it, he would call this grace, right? Last week we talked really about prevenient grace, how God is in our lives even before we're aware of it. Well, God perfects us through grace, and John Wesley called it justifying grace. God brings us back into line. We don't have to do it alone. We can't do it alone. Suffering for Buddhists is the primary human condition. But for Christians, it's only one of the conditions we experience in this life. Suffering is very real for us too. Meditation and mindfulness are useful tools to help us manage our anxiety, to calm our fears, to let go of harmful relationships and addictions that cause us to suffer. But we do not deny that we need food and clothes. Jesus taught, "Why do you worry about what you eat or what you will drink or what you will wear? Don't you know your heavenly Father knows you need those things? But seek first the kingdom of God and God's righteousness, and all those other things will be given to you." It's not that we need detachment. It's that our first attachment needs to be to God. Then the other things will fall into place, especially when we're living in community. Last night, for me, was just another affirmation that we need community to get through our times of suffering. And what joy was shared in the midst of grief. We were able to still laugh together and smile and remember how much Blanche loved children, especially, right? And how she drew her circle wide to include many, many people, not just her family, in that circle of love. God's kingdom is community on a much, much larger scale. If Jesus were detached, would he have cried when he found out that Lazarus had died, even though he knew he was going to bring Lazarus back to life? He loved Lazarus. He loved Mary and Martha, and he hated to see them hurt. And his heart hurt with them. Jesus said, "I came to you so that you might have life, and have it abundantly." Relief from anxiety comes from trusting in the God who loves us. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. We have much to learn from our Buddhist friends. We need to be still. You know the moment of silence that I've been offering after the joys and concerns? How long does that feel to you sometimes, to just sit in silence? Is it too short? Is it too long? I usually count to 15 or 20. It's really short. But for some of us, it feels like forever. Like, when is she going to pray? Right? What would it feel like if we gave ourselves a whole minute of stillness to be with God? We need to be still and live in the moment. We need to be more mindful about prayer and meditation. We need to avoid attaching ourselves to all the wrong things. We need to recognize that this world is transient. Nothing is forever. And not get upset about the things that really don't matter in the larger scheme. We certainly have much to learn about nonviolence and justice and righteousness and love from our Buddhist friends and neighbors. And let us also offer them some of the gifts of Christianity, the hope and the peace of good news that comes from trusting in God and in the promises that Christ made to us and keeps every single day. And so let us proclaim our faith through our hymn of proclamation, trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus. Will you stand and sing with me, number 467?